From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, an insider's view of the neo-Nazi movement. Thomas Martinez became an FBI informer and testified against the extremist fringe he once belonged to. Also today, Tony Auth tells us why political cartoons should be more than gags about headlines. Auth is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His Reagan-era cartoons are collected in a new book. Mac Rebennack returns for his final Fresh Air performance to play the music he made popular as his alter ego, Dr. John the Night Tripper. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews comic Sandra Bernhardt's one-woman show. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Thomas Martinez joined the Ku Klux Klan when he was 21, living in his hometown of Philadelphia. He bought his white hood and robe for $30. Whereas the Klan uses public intimidation like cross burnings as a tactic, the group Martinez was later involved with was totally underground. That group was the Order, the neo-Nazis who murdered talk show host Alan Berg. In 1984, Martinez was arrested for passing counterfeit money for the Order. When faced with prison or becoming an informant, Martinez turned against the Order and began cooperating with the FBI. Martinez led the FBI to the leaders of the Order and testified at trials against them. Although a contract was put on his life, he never joined the Federal Witness Protection Program. In fact, he's gone public, speaking out against neo-Nazi groups. Some of his talks are sponsored by the Jewish Anti-Defamation League. A few weeks ago, he testified at a federal trial in Arkansas, where 13 people, including 5 members of the Order, were accused of plotting to overthrow the government. All 13 were acquitted. Martinez has written a new book about his former affiliation with extremist groups and his subsequent work to stop them. It's titled Brotherhood of Murder. Thomas Martinez, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You've belonged to groups that blamed blacks and Jews for all the problems of the world. Did you have direct contact with Jews or blacks that led you to develop this hatred of them?
Yes, I had direct contact with black people in general. That's where my animosity started, with my racism, basically in junior high school, then, which led on to high school right in the Philadelphia area. I went to Thomas Edison High School in the early 70s, which was a real tough school to go through, especially being white. I was threatened by a gang of black youths there called the Zulu Nation Gang. At that time, was a very dangerous group who murdered a white boy in the Kensington neighborhood where I was from. And they made a threat on me, and I left school that day and never returned, and quit at the age 16 in grade 10. And that's where my animosity started and prejudiced, and it stayed with me till I got involved with the Klan at an early age of my early 20s.
You joined the Ku Klux Klan, and you write in your book that you left the Klan because there wasn't enough action for you. And then you joined the National Alliance, which is a neo-Nazi group. What do you mean that there wasn't enough action with the Klan?
Well, basically, because we were in Philadelphia, it was a very hard time to recruit. The Klan was just not accepted. I mean, people agreed, believe it or not, with our ideology, but wouldn't join the organization per se. But when I met members of the National Alliance, which is actually a version of the American Nazi Party, no uniforms or swastikas, but basically their ideology is towards National Socialism. More educated people I found in the National Socialists, better read. And that attracted me because they seemed to me they had a platform, a political platform. That's what I was looking for. I didn't think that marching around in white sheets and in the woods practicing with weapons was the way to actually convert people into our thinking. So I was looking for a platform of politics, and that's when I went to the National Alliance with other ex-Klan members who were thinking on my level.
In the National Alliance, this neo-Nazi group, Jews were considered the greatest threat of all. Blacks were hated, but Jews were even worse. Would you explain why?
Well, basically, to go back in history, I mean, you know, not to make a long speech about it, but the Nazis were the murderers of Jews and Gentiles and so on. So that's what their ideology was. The National Alliance was a platform of Nazism. So their main target was the Jews. They believed that the Jews, the Zionists of Israel, actually controlled the money system in this country, controlled the lobbyists, and so on.
What appealed to that ideology to you? You had told us a couple of minutes ago that when you were in school, you felt very threatened by black students there. You didn't mention anything about the Jewish students. What appealed to you about this ideology?
When you get involved with these groups, you have men who are doctrines. You have men who are professors of colleges. Dr. William Pierce was a professor of a college. There's a professor at Northwest University by the name of Butts, who written a book called The Hoax of the 20th Century, which he denies the Holocaust ever happened. You had these men always speaking at your platforms. And here I am, a 10th grade dropout from Kensington, not well-read. I mean, I can stand up for my own backing, but I mean, here I am, a young kid, gullible, angry at the system. And I had these men up there indoctrinating me with this ideology, and I'm starting to say, maybe they're telling the truth. Maybe there is a conspiracy of well-financed lobbyists of Israel.
How do you join the National Alliance, this neo-Nazi group? What did you have to do to join?
Well, I was attracted to it from my best friend, who was in a Klan with me, and he was well-read, and he joined the group and kind of brought me in because he met the other members, and that's how I got inside.
Is there an initiation ceremony, or are you sworn in, or anything like that?
No, not like the Klan. No, basically, it's just, you join, and you're accepted, you're accepted. If you're not, you're not.
And what do you have to do to maintain your membership?
Well, we actually went out in the streets with our literature and went door to door, just like the other right wing groups may do, like the LaRucci's. And so we went out basically trying to recruit and have people subscribe to our publications, and stood on street corners, and that's basically what we did in the National Alliance.
Were there things that you would do as a group to psych yourselves up and to really get into a mood of hate?
No, I mean, most people have an image that people just sit around and talk about hate all the time. It's not like that. I mean, we would sit around, of course, and have conversations about, things of maybe Israel. If there was something happening in Israel that special day, we would discuss the situation. Or if there was rioting or problem going on, the blacks were marching somewhere, but we didn't actually talk about murdering people and stuff like that, no.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Martinez, and he was a former member of the Klan and of the National Alliance. He became affiliated with a group called The Order. Well, that was the group that was responsible for the murder of talk show host Alan Berg. Martinez turned against The Order, informed for the FBI, and now speaks out against these neo-Nazi groups. He's the author of a new book called Brotherhood of Murder. Now, you left the National Alliance. You became, what, bored, disillusioned?
Well, in 83, I had a falling out with its leader, Dr. Pierce, and I was having a lot of words with the guys I was inside with on the Holocaust. That was a big thing that bothered me. I didn't know about this Jewish conspiracy because I wasn't aware, I wasn't positive of it, if they were telling the truth or what, but I knew that there was a Holocaust, and this was a real big thing in the neo-Nazi groups, that the Holocaust never occurred, that Nazis never murdered anybody. And my brother lives in Germany for 20 years, and he's married a much older woman who was a child during the war. Her brother was a Nazi soldier who was killed in action. Her father was a stepfather's a Frenchman who used to hide and fight in the resistance. So my sister-in-law actually sat as close as I am with you, Terry, and we talked about this, and she would say, there was not just 6 million people. She's talk about the millions of Gentiles that were murdered by Nazis, the homosexuals that were murdered, children that were retarded. And that woke me up. Here's my sister-in-law who was there, not these National Alliance members, but she was part of it, there to see atrocities. And I asked her, did you ever see the gas chambers? And she said that no, she never per se saw the gas chambers, but she knew the atrocities and murders because the gas chambers are there. You can ride by them in Germany today. I mean, they're there.
Can you just walk out on a group like the National Alliance?
Yes. The National Alliance, you could just quit and move on or just forget about it, but not The Order.
Well, let's get to The Order. One of your best friends was the founder of The Order, and you were actually working for him, not even knowing that The Order existed. That's how secretive The Order was. The Order is based on a novel, a piece of fiction written by one of the founders of the group. Tell us about this book that became basically the Bible of The Order.
Bob Matthews and I met in 1980, in Arlington, Virginia, at a National Alliance convention, where members went every year in September to have our have our convention where our leader, Dr. Pierce, would speak to us, and we would be in contact with other leaders. Bob Matthews was a man from a small town called Medellin Falls, Washington. No Jews, no blacks, population almost 800 people. Beautiful land. And Bob was indoctrinated through this stuff at the age of 16 through the John Birch Society, then went on to the neo-Nazi ideology. And he started reading a lot. He was a very bored individual, had hardly any friends, lived in a small town. There was nothing really to do but read and get involved in something. And his involvement was politics. He came across a book called The Turner's Diary, which our so-called leader, William Pierce, wrote under an assumed name of MacDonald. And the book talks about an organization called The Order, secretive organization, that has plots to assassinate prominent people around the country, assassinate talk show hosts, personalities, people who actually speak up against the group, The Order, sabotage our water supply system, counterfeiting, and it goes on and on and on. And this book is a man inside by the name of Earl Turner, and Bob plays the part of Earl Turner in his own mind and forms a secret society on his farm in October 1983 called the Brüdenschwagen to its members, known as the Silent Brotherhood, more known to you as the Order.
Well, why was it so important within the ideology of this group to keep it absolutely secret, totally underground?
Because the crimes that they were going to commit were going to finance the upper level, the groups that were out in the public, like the Klan, the National Alliance, the White Aryan Resistance, these hate movements. They were to finance the leaders so the leaders could get the propaganda out to the people from their soldiers who were open. And if the leaders saw a good recruit who they believed in the ideology of terrorism, then he would send them down to the Order.
How would you become a member of the group?
Of the
Order?
The Order was word of mouth. I mean, it was a person who had to really trust you to try to bring you in. But Matthews, what he did was, testifying in a Seattle trial, 295 people testified. And many of the people, just like myself, were kind of sucked into it. And when I say that, I mean by he would come and buy people. He had people putting answering machines in their house saying it was just for the racial cause, give them $500,000 or $1,000. People didn't realize what they were doing. Most people were in it for money, greed, like myself. I quit in 1983, all this stuff. And when he came around with me, it was strictly the money. I personally did not know what I was getting into.
Okay. Part of the goal of the Order was to, as you said, assassinate certain leaders, create havoc in the country. Mm-hmm. Weapons were needed for those plans. What kind of arsenal did the Order actually have, and how did they get the weapons that they had?
When I cooperated with the government, of course, I knew quite a bit, but there was a lot of things I didn't know. And the government then started putting in informants, and the government had over 300 FBI, U.S. Marshals, and Secret Service investigating this organization. They also found out in North Carolina there was an inside man in one of the military bases of our own government who was actually stealing weapons out of one of the military bases and selling them to the Order. They also had their own store, which they opened up as a front, a supply store that they were buying guns and weapons and supplies. And basically, it was not a store to sell to the public. It was for the organization.
Now, let me see if I have this straight. You left the National Alliance in around 83, and you didn't want to be a member of these extremist neo-Nazi groups anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But you were still good friends with Bob Matthews, the guy who founded the Order.
Right.
You didn't know that the Order existed, but you knew that he was committing robberies and counterfeiting money,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to involve you
mm-hmm.
in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So how did he approach you? What did he tell you he wanted you for?
Well, he called me up one night in the winter. I bought this house, and I'm not trying to play a violin or look for sympathy. This house I bought was a handyman special in Philadelphia, and the real estate ripped me off. They had sold me a house with bad beams, and the second night in there, my roof was ready to collapse. It was all rotted beams. It was $5,000 a roofer wanted. I didn't have $5,000. The toilet busted the fourth night I was in there. I mean, just everything was breaking. I was totally wiped out because the money I had was all on my escrow and so on. And here I busted my leg in work. I broke all my bones in my foot. A garage door fell on me. Matthews came around at Christmas time with a bag full of money, asking me to help pass this bank money that a man by the name of Carlos robbed the bank for the movement. I told him I didn't want nothing to do with it. It was like the next day, you know, come on, buddy, and all this stuff. I'll help you with your roof. And he gave me $500 to have a roofer just come and put plywood up there and put hot tar to preserve the wood till I can get enough. And he conned me into it with money, strictly money. And next thing you know it, he's telling me that there was a counterfeit operation. He could help me out. And I asked him, what's the counterfeit operation's purpose for? And in counterfeiting, he said, was to try to get people like myself and others who are willing to move out of the cities and buy some businesses, and that'll be it. And to be honest with you, as I sit here today, you know, it's 4 years ago this happened. It was very stupid, very weak and gullible. You know, when I look back, the average person probably wouldn't have done what I did. At least I don't think they would have. But let me tell you something. When somebody's got thousands, and I'm talking thousands of dollars on a table looking at you in the face, you become very greedy, and you don't think about ever getting caught.
So you decided to pass the counterfeit money so that you can make some profit off of it, too.
Yes, yes.
Did you ever find out, I mean, how did you find out about his affiliation with the order?
Well, after my arrest, of course, I needed a lawyer, and a lawyer wanted to
So it wasn't until you were arrested
that you knew
anything about the order?
After I was arrested, that's when he explained to me all about this group, the Brüdenschwagen. Of course, you know, you don't sit there and say to Bob Matthews, after you know now he's telling you he was involved with killing a guy named Berg, then he'd find out they kill one of their own, and you know, they're just well organized. They have cells operating around the country now. You don't sit there and say, hey, Bob, why didn't you tell me this in January? Because he'd pull a trigger out on you. Maybe not him, but one of his comrades would come and kill you or your family. I mean, you had to be very careful. I was into it up to my neck. I mean, I couldn't go to the federal agencies because here, what do? Walk in and say, oh, yeah, I was once a KKK member, a neo-Nazi. Yeah, I helped pass bank money. Oh, yeah, I let this guy who robbed the bank stay at my house. Oh, yeah, I was just guilty as sin. I was just as bad as they were. And I was in the middle. I didn't know what to do. But when they start talking about what they wanted to do and their plans of doing it, it scared the hell out of me. I mean, these guys were talking about polluting our water supply system, New York, putting cyanide in it. They had it. Talking about killing Henry Kissinger, and they had over $4 million of unmarked money. They were talking about killing a prominent attorney in Alabama by the name of Mars Dees. Talking about blowing up the Boundary Dam in Washington State, which they had the blueprints. Los Angeles Power Supply Company, they're going to blow up to create animosity in the city of rioting, hoping if they shut the power down at that night at a certain date, blacks would start looting the stores, and this would cause news of showing how the blacks really are in the white people's eyes. And this was what their sabotage was going to be, blowing up railroad supplies, air transportation. It was scary as hell.
So your friend who founded the order told you all of this?
Oh, yeah, because he wanted me to go underground.
He was afraid that you were going to be swayed one way or another. Either you'd go underground or you'd talk.
I was already arrested for counterfeiting. You're talking three counts at the same store.
I want to talk with you about why you decided to inform for the FBI, but first we're going to take a short break. If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Martinez, and he used to belong to several neo-Nazi extremist groups. He turned against them and informed for the FBI. He's also written a book about his work, and it's called Brotherhood of Murder. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Thomas Martinez is my guest, and we were just about to get into your decision to inform for the FBI. Why did you go that way instead of going underground?
Well, October the 1st, the day of my trial, in front of one of the toughest judges in Philadelphia, Judge Van Artsdown, I knew right now that the Boundary Dam and another dam was going to go up. Besides that, the biggest heist in the world was going to be pulled off. That was $30 to $50 million. That money was going to be stolen out of San Francisco. There was a clean shipment of money from Hawaii apparently coming in. They would have got away with it because the order had two managers inside Brinks who had the blueprints of the building. And I knew for sure if they had went into that building with the tight security, people would have been murdered, been killed. It would have been a bloodbath. They would have got away with that money, believe me, because they had the inside. It scared me. I mean, we're not just talking about, I don't want anybody killed. I want your listeners to hear this. But we're not talking about one person, two people. We're talking about thousands of people who are going to die. $30 to $50 million in the hands of Bob Matthews and his followers, they could have bought mercenaries. They could have bought the average guy off the street to do their dirty work of planting bombs all over. I mean, these guys have planted a couple of bombs in synagogues. They murdered three people. Just in 1 year's time, they robbed three armored cars, a few banks, a few stores, blew up a porno store. I mean, the list goes on and on and on as I discuss about this. It scared me. The government offered me immunity twice because I've never had a prior record in my life, never had any trouble with the law. I turned that down because I figured you talk, you walk. That wasn't my style. I don't want no immunity. I deserve punishment. I mean, I deserve something. And I thought that was a coward's way out. To talk, you walk. That wasn't me. So I walked in with no immunity, and I said, I want to talk to somebody. And I didn't know what was going to be thrown at me. I could have been sentenced to 2-3 years, whatever. And I couldn't handle it no more because my nerves were shot. I lost a lot of weight. I was taking Valiums. I mean, I couldn't handle the stuff I knew was going to happen. And when I went in there, I sat there and I talked to the Secret Service, and they told me to hold. They couldn't believe what I knew. And they brought the FBI right in to investigate this. And from that day of cooperation, there was over 300 FBI agents called in from Washington to investigate this group. And everything I said they was found out was the truth.
How did you lead the FBI to a hotel or a motel where a lot of the members of the order were gathered? What was the setup?
Well, I told the FBI where they could find Matthews because they were real concerned. They had to reach him, and he was really smooth. He was in Wyoming with his mistress he had, who had just bore a child, and he picked up FBI surveillance, and he had his girlfriend dress up in his clothes. They followed her by mistake, and he got away again. And I told the FBI I will lead them to Matthews under two conditions, that they wouldn't reveal my involvement because I'd be a dead man, and that no one would get hurt, not even Matthews. They agreed. I led them to Portland, Oregon. Before that, I led them to Gary Yarborough, the man who actually had the murder weapon and killed Alan Berg. He got away. He shot it out with the FBI in Idaho and got away. And he ended up at this motel with Matthews. But the thing is, Matthews lied to me. He said he was alone. And he was surveilling this airport out, and he picked up FBI surveillance, which he thought. And as I got in the car, this Yarborough, who I'd never met, got in behind me and put a machine gun on me with a silencer, and they took off in the streets of Portland. And as we did, they pulled hand grenades out and had them on the side of their seats. And they watched if this car would pull out, and it turned out it was an FBI was following us. And they lost the FBI in Portland. It was real bad weather. It was raining like cats and dogs out there. And they took me in this wooded area, dead end, out in the woods in this car. And I'll be honest with you, I thought I was a dead man because they murdered one of their own just prior to that and took him in the woods and killed him and buried his body. And as I went out there, I had no choice but to stay in the car because I thought about jumping out the car, but he was driving so fast, I just had to stay put. And they went in the woods and just shut the lights off for this car and waited to see if this car that pulled out of the airport would come down. And thank God it didn't. The FBI lost me. So the following day, as we go back to this motel to move the story up a little, there was a gun eruption there, which wasn't planned by the FBI, but Matthews come out of his room towards my room to get me, and an FBI agent was shot. The manager of the motel was shot. Yarborough was captured, but Matthews was shot in the hand and escaped.
And he was later killed in a shootout between the police.
He was later killed a couple weeks later.
So anyways, you led the cops to members of the order.
Yes.
Most of them were apprehended. The leader got away, but was later killed in the shootout. So what happened to the order? It disappeared after most of the leaders were arrested?
Before trial, there was a man who hired somebody to decapitate me. He hired an FBI agent who he thought was a hitman. And there was photos taken of myself decapitated and presented to these men by the FBI. I went to a special lab and doctored these photos up. They thought I was dead. And they found out more information of another man who formed an order too. But yes, they were all apprehended and sentenced in RICO statute in Seattle and are serving lengthy prison sentences.
You're still speaking now. You know, you're still testifying at trials. You've written this book. You're being very outspoken about what really happens in the neo-Nazi groups. Yet you've declined and offered to participate in the witness protection program. Why decline that?
Well, federal witness protection program is good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not putting it down. But again, I think I'm a very different individual. Some might think, well, this guy's crazy, but I'm really not. The thing is, it's a coward's way out. I mean, you know, I could go in there and hide for the rest of my life and be protected for the rest of my life and have a home and everything given to me. That's just not me. I made my own bed, and I have amends to make. I have two children I have to answer to one day. I have a 13-year-old daughter now and a 7-year-old son. And by me reaching the audiences today, at least for the first time, they can hear it from a guy who's inside these groups. If they have sons in these groups, they know, you know, firsthand what's going on.
A good deal of your adult life was spent working with neo-Nazi groups. You dropped out of one of them. You still work peripherally with another. And now you're speaking out against all these hate groups. What kind of change happened in you? I think that's what I really want to understand, is how you went from truly hating blacks and Jews and blaming them for all of the world's problems to now feeling that was a mistake. Well, I mean, what we talked about changes that happened in your life, being in and out of groups. So what happened inside that was different?
See, I never gave other people a chance. When I talked about black people, I accused a gang of thugs, and I accused a whole black race for these bad guys in high school. And I never wanted to be around any type of blacks, when I mean even the good blacks. Same thing with Jewish people. I had no contact with Jewish peoples. And that's why when I went inside with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, I met Jewish people for the first time in my life. And for 4 years, I've been talking to hundreds around this country in the thousands of groups of Jewish people. I've been one-on-one in their homes, everything. And I am very much accepted, and I accept them. And it's my past. I'm ashamed of my past. I was a very ignorant and weak individual. But, you know, people do change. But sometimes it needs things like this to wake people up to see.
When you do something a lot, it becomes a habit. It becomes almost like a reflex. And when you hate a certain group a lot, it becomes a reflex to see a member of that group and just hate them. Do you still have that and have to stop it? I mean,
have the hate in me?
Yeah.
No. I speak to some of the schools around the country, private schools, and it's basically Hispanics, blacks, Jews, Gentiles, Asians, different kids. And there is no hate there. I mean, I admit my faults. Yes, I had a lot of bitterness in me, but it was my own ignorance. I mean, if people want me to get on my knees and ask for forgiveness, forget it. I'm not going to go that far. They'll take my word as a man. I'm sorry, and I'm trying to make amends for my past by staying out of the Federal Witness Protection Program. I mean, my life's on the line every time I come out and do things like this. I mean, there was already an attempt on my life. We're not playing with kids' stuff. I mean, I have children to worry about. But, you know, all I can say to people who once knew me or my ideology is I'm sorry for my past. That's all I can do, and try to make up for it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your past and your present. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
My guest has been Thomas Martinez, and for many years he was affiliated with neo-Nazi groups, but then he turned against them and formed for the FBI, and now speaks out against those groups in public speeches and in his new book, which is titled Brotherhood of Murder, and that's just been published by McGraw-Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with novelist J.G. Ballard. He's the author of the largely autobiographical book Empire of the Sun, which Steven Spielberg made into a movie last year. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jules Pfeiffer praises his fellow political cartoonist Tony Off for not picking on Ronald Reagan's superficial defects, but for going after his extremism and hypocrisy. Coming up, we hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Tony Off, whose Reagan-era cartoons are collected in a new book. Also, Mac Rebinac concludes his series of Fresh Air performances. Today he plays some of the music he popularized under the name Dr. John the Night Tripper. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the new one-woman show by comic Sandra Bernhardt. Bernhardt is the actress who terrorized Jerry Lewis in the film King of Comedy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan announced today a change in the rules of engagement for U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf. U.S. warships are now free to assist neutral ships under attack if requested. Officials say the policy change does not tilt the U.S. towards the Iraqis or the Iranians in the war. The announcement comes 11 days after U.S. forces disabled half of the 12-ship Iranian Navy in retaliation for the mining of a U.S. warship. U.S. officials in Washington say the Reagan administration has the broad outlines of a formula that would lead to the departure of Panamanian General Manuel Noriega. There is no deal yet, but the proposal would allow Noriega to resign as defense chief but stay in Panama. Previously, the administration had insisted Noriega leave the country. State Department official Michael Kozak is back in Washington today after meeting earlier this week with Noriega. In Nicaragua, the Contras have offered the government some concessions in an effort to break a deadlock in talks on the technical details of a 60-day ceasefire. David Golub reports.
Contra leader Adolfo Calero said today that the rebels were dropping their demand to be resupplied with munitions and weapons during the course of the 60-day ceasefire. He also said the rebels were prepared to respect the sovereignty and indivisibility of national territory. In other words, that the Contras would not try to turn the ceasefire zones in which they are supposed to regroup into liberated territory under their control. Calero said these concessions would remove two big stumbling blocks toward an agreement, but they're unlikely to satisfy the government. The government wants the Contras to give guarantees that they are willing to agree to a permanent peace, not just the details of the temporary truce, which is already half over. Contra leaders say talk of a permanent settlement must come later. For National Public Radio, I'm David Golub in Managua.
Four Democratic leaders of the Senate held a news conference today to say the INF treaty will be brought to the Senate floor for debate in mid-May, but only if four issues are resolved before then. NPR's Jim Engel has the details.
Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd said there are serious problems with the INF treaty, which bans all medium and shorter-range missiles, but he and other Senate Democratic leaders said they believe those problems can be resolved, and they urged the Soviets and the administration to do so in the next 10 days so the Senate debate can go forward. The Senate Democrats blamed the Soviets for violating the INF agreement by disputing this week the right of the U.S. to make some on-site inspections, which the U.S. believes are clearly covered by the agreement. There are also differing interpretations of the language in two key passages of the treaty. Byrd and the other Senate Democratic leaders said if differences in interpretation aren't resolved now and come up after ratification, it would damage the whole arms control process.
That would have a chilling effect upon future progress toward arms control. As we get our fingers burned on this, then it isn't going to augur well for future arms control agreements.
Byrd said the treaty could be ratified in time for the Moscow summit if these issues are resolved. I'm Jim Engel in Washington.
The government of Kuwait struck a deal with the hijackers of one of its jumbo jets in order to end the hostage siege. That's according to the Associated Press, which quotes U.S. officials as saying Kuwait agreed to prematurely release some of the 17 terrorists held in its jails if the hijackers freed their remaining 31 hostages. Algeria served as an intermediary in the hijacking. Previously, it had been announced that no deals were made. Strikes and rioting over a gasoline price hike in Nigeria have closed the capital city of Lagos' international airport. Radio Nigeria reported today that thousands of travelers are stranded. Earlier this month, a modest increase in the price of gas sparked student unrest in the northern part of the country. Even though the government declared all walkouts illegal, the strikes have paralyzed many banks and hospitals. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones average fell nearly 9 points to close at 2032.33. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For the past few weeks, we've been hearing from our performer-in-residence, Mac Rebenek. Mostly, he's been sharing the music he grew up hearing and playing in his native New Orleans. For his last performance with us, Mac Rebenek plays his own music from the 1960s. That's when he combined elements of voodoo, psychedelia, and medicine shows under the persona of Dr. John the Night Tripper.
Yeah, down in South Louisiana, we got a thing they call, in Haiti, they call it hoodoo, and other areas they call it sanery and other names. But in Louisiana, we call it gri-gri, and it's a little homegrown form of herbal remedies and homeopathic medicine or whatever you like to call it. But did an album in tribute to this called Gri-Gri under the name of Dr. John the Night Tripper, and here's a little bit of that music called I Walk on Gilded Splinters. Some people think I'm jiving. I know they must be crazy. Don't see their misfortune, else they just lazy. Just be the Grand Zombie. My yellow belt is shawls on. Ain't afraid of no tomcats, and I fill my brain with poison. Walk through the fire, fly through the smoke. See my enemy on the end of their road. Walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with the king of the Zulu. Had a thing about you, con, boone, kill it, con. Walk on gilded splinters, con, boone, kill it, con. Walk on gilded splinters. Roll out my coffin, I drink poison in my chalice. Your pride begin to fade, you're all gonna feel my malice. Some gri-gri on your doorstep, soon you'll be in the gutter. Melt your heart like butter, I could make you stutter. What you gonna do, make kill it, con. Walk on gilded splendors, con, do make kill it, con. Walk on gilded splendors. Up note, here's a little tune I like to do called Such a Night. I had the pleasure of doing it in the last waltz with the band. Such a night. Such a night. Sweet confusion. Such a night, such a night. Got to steal away. Time seemed right. Baby, your eyes met mine, and at a glance, you let me know this was my chance. You came in with my best friend Jim. Here I am, and I'm trying to steal you away from him. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, child, somebody else will. And it's a such a night. Such a night, sweet confusion. Time seemed bright. Such a night, such a night. Got to steal away under the moonlight. Baby, I couldn't believe my ears. My heart just skipped a beat. Told me we could slip away, yeah. Down a dark end of the street, came here with my best friend Jim. Here I am, I'm trying to steal you away from him. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. I don't do it, somebody else will, and I'm gonna leave you with a little Professor Longhead grooves that I always love to play. I think something like this.
Dr. John's classic recording of Night Tripper music, Gree Gree, has been reissued by Alligator Records. This is Fresh Air. Tony Auth has a political cartoon depicting Mount Rushmore. George Washington says, how are they going to celebrate the bicentennial of the Constitution? Thomas Jefferson replies, with a fairly major assault, secret war, contempt of Congress, abuse of power, laundering of funds, imperial presidency, the usual stuff. This is one of the cartoons collected in Auth's new book, Lost in Space, The Reagan Years. Tony Auth is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is syndicated in 100 other papers. In looking back on the Reagan era, Auth told me that he believes Reagan's attack on domestic social programs marked a turning point for many political cartoonists.
When he started devastating various domestic programs, and especially since the Reagan administration was using the term truly needy, and that was something that we could latch onto and use against the administration. They stopped using that term. And it was, in fact, in reaction against one of my cartoons, I'm told.
Describe the cartoon that it was a reaction to.
Well, I think the one they said was when I had them launching a presidential yacht, which Reagan had named the Truly Needy.
Now, how did this get back to you?
The New Yorker did a piece on it, and they mentioned that in the piece.
So that shows that a cartoonist can actually have some influence, which is something
strange,
I'm sure you've
but
doubted,
true.
Right? No, but seriously, I bet you have doubted that.
Of course.
Now, there's also a cartoon where Reagan is basically acting as a pimp for Marcos, offering him... offering him the Statue of Liberty, and he's telling the Statue of Liberty, he's handing the Statue of Liberty a sheer bra and some stockings and is saying something like, put this on and act like you're enjoying it.
Right.
And Marcos is in another room looking very sleazy, and Reagan, I should say, in the role of the pimp, is wearing a flowered shirt and pinstripe bell-bottoms with two-tone pointy shoes. How did you come up with this idea of showing him as a pimp compromising democracy by quote, having democracy go to bed with Marcos?
Yeah. You know, one of my techniques is to say, okay, what's really going on here? And in that case, it was a fairly easy thing. And then the trick is to somehow communicate Reagan's persona in a strange and metaphorical way and still have it work. And I don't know if it didn't. I'm sure I lost a lot of people on that cartoon.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because I bet it offended a lot of people. I think I've seen cartoons where there's some kind of image of two political leaders going to bed together. But to have Reagan literally dressed as a pimp, I can't say I've seen an image like that before in a political cartoon.
Yeah.
So did you get a lot of criticism for it, angry letters, anything like that?
Well, a few angry letters, but not as many as I would have expected.
Washington correspondents, when they're covering a president, they travel with the president. They're there for the press conferences. They'll go on the road if the president goes on the road. How do you get your take on the president? Is it by reading? Do you ever go see the president? Or
no, I think that would be a very counterproductive activity. No, it's very essentially lonely work. I mean, I spend more time reading than doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The cartoonists, though, as an organization, meet every other year in Washington, and they try desperately to see the president. And the last time they had a Rose Garden audience, and I boycotted it because I just think it's really silly.
Why do you think it's silly?
Well, because I think in that kind of a situation, the president is trying to use the cartoonists. And I think that more than anything else, the atmosphere that is, the attitude that is generated by the president and they're trying to get everybody to buy into is one that, well, you know, basically you guys draw these funny pictures and we're the politicians and we're all in this together and it's not very serious.
So you take it more seriously than that. It's not just little jokes.
Well, I think cartoonists have a problem being taken seriously in any event, and I do everything I can to not play the clown and to not have that attitude be accepted. And a lot of cartoonists cooperate with that. I mean, they wear strange clothes and they joke about who they're going to vote for, who's the easiest to draw. All that kind of stuff kind of annoys me.
Who's the easiest to draw? Now that really cheapens the political message of a cartoon.
Of course, as if what we were about was filling the editorial pages with people that we could draw easily.
You have a cartoon that basically mocks President Reagan's budget. I think budgets are hard to cartoon without doing like pie graphs, pie
right.
charts and things like that.
Right.
Would you read the captions and describe what you've done with this?
Well, this is a 6-panel cartoon, and it's Reagan reading his budget. And he says, the cities, we can't afford them. Education, we can't afford it. Transportation, we can't afford it. Farm subsidies, we can't afford them. Environmental protection, we can't afford it. And then he slams the book shut, and his expression changes to one of ferocity, and he says, defense, we can't afford not to protect our cities, schools, transportation, farms, and environment.
I like that very much. I think you've gotten to things that are, again, hard to get to in a cartoon. Any insights you can give us into how you came up with that idea?
Well, like many of them, this just comes from reading the news stories. And this was a story about the budget and what had happened to the budget and you know, just free associating and how to, you know, once I figure out what I want to say, the craft part takes over, and that's generally enjoyable.
The introduction to your book is written by your friend and colleague, cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer, and I want to read a couple of things that Pfeiffer has to say about you. Tony Auth's cartoons are not just funny, they have true political content. Unlike too many of his colleagues, Auth doesn't pick on Ronald Reagan for his superficial defects. His argument is with Reagan's extremism, callousness, hypocrisy, and ignorance, all of which he presents to us with humor. I wonder what your reaction is. I don't mean to put you on the spot and have you pass judgment on your colleagues, but do you agree with Pfeiffer that a lot of political cartoons today are funny, but they don't really have political grit? They don't really go to the heart of the political issue?
Well, that is a problem that cartoonists often talk about when they get together. There is a tendency to do gags about the headlines
mm-hmm.
and to print them on the editorial page. And what comes to mind is Jerry Ford and all the cartoons and commentary about him bumping his head. And I never did one cartoon about him bumping his head, because the fact of the matter is he's probably the greatest athlete that we've ever had elected president. He slips once. You know, if people were photographing us all the time, God knows what the...
Oh, not me.
But actually, I did use it once as a metaphor for him slipping in with regard to some sort of policy or something. That, to me, makes it work, and then you can use that as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But to do jokes about somebody hitting their head is just, you know, so what?
You got started, didn't you, at Underground Papers?
Yes.
That must have been good in the sense that you were really expected to be outspoken there. Anything goes.
I had more trouble there than at the Inquirer.
No, really?
Yes, because underground editors tended to think that they knew the truth.
Oh, so you had to be politically correct.
Right. The worst thing for a cartoonist is to have an editor who thinks he knows the truth.
Funny how that works. You came of age as a cartoonist with Watergate.
Yes.
Well,
Vietnam and Watergate.
Okay. Was it good for Tony Auth that there was Watergate? That's not what I mean. but I mean you had issues.
Paradox.
I know, but you had issues that really mattered to people when you started cartooning professionally.
Well, I think
I'm not saying that issues now don't matter,
no,
but there are times when there aren't really big issues.
Yes, and I think that political cartoonists are caused by social upheaval. I would have been a medical illustrator, as I was, had it not been for Vietnam and then Watergate. And in the 50s, in the very early 60s, Herblock and Conrad and Malden used to sit around and say, what's happening to our profession? It's dying. We have no new blood. And all they needed was a Vietnam and a civil rights movement, followed by a Watergate, what you had was waves of cartoonists being, you know, put ashore who otherwise would have been something else.
Tony, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Political cartoonist Tony Auth, his new book, Lost in Space, is published by Andrews and McMeel. You're listening to Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what they have planned. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're going to hear firsthand from one of the passengers about that horrifying airline accident in Hawaii yesterday, in which the roof of a Boeing 737 was ripped off at 24,000 feet. Federal investigators reportedly think the cause was not a bomb, but structural failure. And we're going to talk to a reporter in Poland about the labor strikes there. We're going to find out more about the painful economic dilemmas facing both workers and the government. And Terry, have you ever noticed that in cigarette ads, when they hold lit cigarettes, there's no smoke?
I've never really noticed. Is that true?
It certainly is, and we're going to find out why tonight.
Thanks. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Comedian Sandra Bernhardt says her father is a proctologist, her mother is an abstract artist, and that's why she views the world the way she does. Bernhardt's currently performing in a one-woman show off-Broadway. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone has a review.
I've long admired Sandra Bernhardt. She played the crazed fan of Jerry Lewis in King of Comedy, and for years she toured the country in a thrilling stand-up act. You may know her from Shots on Letterman. She sits across from him, her body a hanger, her fingers styling mousse tresses, and exposes the breadth of her absorption with ordinariness. Rockstar gossip, TV celebs, her own ravenous hunger to run ahead of the pack. Her frankness strips anyone veiling their self-absorption and love of banality. She terrifies and excites Letterman. Responses escape his control. Arg, back vampire, not feelings, not the death of cool. She gets juiced by her power, his vulnerability pumping her confidence, sharpening her understanding of repression. This is premium Punch and Judy. Bernhardt plays so well on TV because she isn't afraid of it, but knowing the medium doesn't exempt her from its ills. She wants the sort of fame that is TV's special product, becoming a household name. She complains on TV she's not famous enough, and she gripes to print reporters too. The irony she used to lend the subject has disintegrated. I went to her show, called Without You, I'm Nothing, now playing at the Orpheum Theater in New York, hoping for wit. Unfortunately, much of it wilts beneath her drive for fame. She wants this piece to catapult her career, the way Solo Evenings boosted Whoopi Goldberg and Jackie Mason. Maybe it will, but the work isn't a step forward. A collection of autobiographical monologues, fantasy riffs, and musical numbers, it's mostly inert. It doesn't know what it's trying to say, except take Sandra seriously. The performance quickens when she sings, and also during an improv segment where she kibitzes with the audience and nips the critics, including yours truly. To be sure, there are funny bits and some well-aimed satire in the show. Bernhard raps photographer Bruce Weber for using women as accessories in his Calvin Klein ads and in his layouts for Ralph Lauren for fetishizing white upper-class America. And she blasts Joni Mitchell for singing about Ethiopia and not having budged from the Malibu colony in 10 years. But these moments aren't abundant. Instead of reveling, as she used to, in the crude pleasures of showing off her clothes and being advertising's plaything, a happy consumer, Bernhard now mentions brand names in italics, as if diction constituted a critique of media. She borrows the worst in performance art, substituting a representation of reality for a social view and draining the fun, felt to be beneath art, from simple gratifications. Her stories trail off pointlessly or wind into private associations or devolve to pettiness and bile. She hates her father's second wife because the woman talks nasal. She loathes a famous fashion photographer just as much for being homosexual as for being a snob. A whole number is devoted to Bernhard's ex-manager, who's accused of obstructing her path to fame and who gets attacked for being fat. Sandra, someone is going to give you the talk show you deserve. You're going to turn people upside down, and we're going to hear their pretensions clatter to the floor like loose change. In the meantime, think hard about what you're trying to say, and don't hand out the pathetic excuse for mediocrity you gave Newsweek, quote, "This is a stale age, and it's impossible to be fresh today," unquote. That statement is the fashion equivalent of wearing Reeboks with an Armani.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with cabaret singer Weslia Whitfield. Bay Area audiences have long regarded her as their private treasure, but with a recent record and club dates in Hollywood and New York, her reputation is spreading. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Twilight Dreams, the new album by Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy. And television critic David Bianculli will preview the CBS remake of The Caine Mutiny. It stars Brad Davis, Jeff Daniels, and Eric Bogosian, and it's directed by Robert Altman. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WEVO, in Concord, New Hampshire. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.